If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify's got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be rejoined today by Scott Mendelson. Now, I've had Scott on a bunch of times. There's always box office stuff to talk about on this podcast, especially this time of year. But there's some kind of interesting political wrinkles here that we're going to get into in a second. But first, Scott, thanks for being back on the show.
Oh, it's absolutely a pleasure. Thank you for having me. And yeah, there's a lot of macro stuff interfering with the micro stuff that I'm sure we will talk about today. And that's basically the big story of the world in general, not just entertainment.
Of the American economy. Rush Hour. Rush Hour is the thing here. This is what I had kind of wanted to talk to you about, because it is, let us grant that Paramount Skydance green lighting a new Rush Hour 4 at the behest of the Trump White House to help their sex pest friend Brett Ratner out is a bribe. Let's just say that that's a thing that's being done to grease the skids of any potential Warner Brothers deal. And we'll talk about that more in a bit, too. Let's just look at this from a pure box office perspective. I will play devil's advocate here. And I will say, Scott, I will say that there is no difference between this and many of the other IP plays. We see so many resurrections and reboots and whatever. It's no different, right? Or am I wrong? Is this a much worse deal?
Well, I mean, it's a much worse deal because of the circumstances, and whether it's a bribe or whether it's an affirmative response to a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, do it or else request. And I think both are maybe the same sandbox. This film would not be happening, if it does happen. Obviously, things change. Absent Donald Trump saying, please make it. And while it may be not that dissimilar to any number of revivals, revamps, or what have you that we've seen over the last dozen or so years, most of those were bad ideas too, commercially, and most of them bombed as well. Mm. I mean, everybody spent, what happened to The Running Man? I thought Glenn Powell was a star. It's like, A, he's a star when he's a romantic lead, not an action hero. We should have learned that from Channing Tatum and Patrick Swayze. But also, I mean, Total Recall bombed, RoboCop bombed. If they go through with it, Star Wars, Starship Troopers will bomb. We haven't had a hit Terminator film in 20 years. I mean, even Bread or Badlands, great movie, but it's barely going to skate by the skin of its teeth. Because as good as it was, the only people that were interested were people that were already interested in a Predator movie. Whatever. But the thing with this is that the first Rush Hour, huge hit, breakout sequel. Ironically, a pinnacle example of, in the late 90s, the kind of film that I felt was an aspirational success by virtue of what we would now call DEI and or wokeness. Mm-hmm. But back then, we probably called it political correctness. And again, I don't mean that as a criticism, but plenty of other people might, in that it was, hey, look, this $40 million studio programmer, original movie starring Chris Tucker, whose Money Talks was not a blockbuster, and Jackie Chan, who has had minimal at best success breaking out in North America. And I say that as somebody that saw Rumble in the Bronx and Super Cop and First Strike in theaters. all of a sudden that movie opens with $38 million in mid-September and legs out to around $245 million. Massive hit. 3 years later, Rush Hour 2 is a breakout sequel. It opens with $66 million, almost breaks the opening weekend record. Legs out to $350, roughly, on a $90 million budget. But 2007, 6 years later, Rush Hour 3 somehow costs around $180 million. Again, everybody's getting paid, yada, yada, yada. The movie performs so poorly, 250-ish, give or take, 255, that it is a key reason, along with the Golden Compass, that New Line Cinema stops being an independent studio and becomes explicitly merged with Warner Brothers in early 2008. So now, you know, it's an IP that not only did it fail last time out, it failed to a earth-shaking, game-changing level. It'd be like making a sequel to Heaven's Gate.
Well, I was going to say, it pulled a Heaven's Gate. You know, Heaven's Gate famously is the movie that destroyed United Artists for a while. They folded that studio. It's chronicled in the book Final Cut. Great book. You should read it. But but not you. I mean, the listeners out there, I'm sure you've read. But that's a real Heaven's Gate situation.
And to be fair, New Line Cinema is still around. They're still with Warner, and they're still, frankly, they had a banger 2025. Making the kind of smaller budget of the moment speaks to today's audiences kind of films that, I mean, say what you will, New Line in the 80s and 90s had their finger on the pulse like nobody else. Ninja Turtles, Spawn, Rush Hour, Blade, Boogie Nights, 100 other ones that I'm forgetting about, but you get the idea. But generally speaking, when you're doing, should we bring back this old franchise that was once a big hit? You have to ask yourself two big questions. A, was the last one successful? And B, was this a franchise that only really worked once? And I'm talking about commercially. You know, I love Legion, The Exorcist 3. I'm not going to pretend it was a blockbuster. So like The Exorcist, that was an astonishing super duper mega smash hit. Adjusted for inflation, is probably the biggest grossing R-rated movie of all time. But none of the other sequels, even noting inflation, did all that well. The Matrix Resurrections, which I quite like, but then, you know, I never remember which Wachowski sister directed it, Mia Culpa, but giving her $190 million to basically make the ultimate self-loathing blockbuster, as artistically impressive as that might be, was setting $190 million on fire. And that a big reason for that was The Matrix Revolutions earned almost half of what The Matrix Reloaded did 20 years ago. And while I am absolutely a sequel defender, commercially, 50% of the audience 20 years ago decided between parts two and part three to say, nope, I'm done. And yet the idea that like 20 years later, everyone was going to go, oh yeah, I'm back on board. No, that's not how this works. Now, there are examples of you know, long gestating fourquels doing better than the threequel. Like Jurassic World Park 3 wasn't a huge hit, but it was a hit, and it wasn't a bomb. But Rush Hour 3, the last one flopped. The Matrix Revolutions. I'm not going to say it flopped, but it was a big disappointment. So when you're, you know, and like Gremlins 3, do you remember that the second Gremlins, which I love, was sort of the definitive example of sometimes it only works once. The first Gremlins made about 150 domestic. The second Gremlins made about 30 domestic, give or take. So this is not going to be Bad Boys for Life. And here's why.
Right. Well, that's the obvious counter here, right? Is, well, look at Bad Boys for Life. Will Smith comes back and Martin Lawrence comes back and it's a big hit.
Well, Will Smith, while he's only been bankable in franchises and as marquee characters for the last decade, which is movie stardom in a nutshell for most people, you know, he's still huge as the genie in Aladdin. He's a huge added value element to something like Suicide Squad. And people show up when he makes a sequel to a previous franchise of his, like Bad Boys. However, that film opened in early 2020. It cost $90 million. So people were obviously doing it for the love of the game and back-end pay and all that fun stuff. Part of the reason it broke out is because it was shockingly good. And I can only speak for myself. I was not expecting Bad Boys for Life to be anywhere near as good as it was. That was partially because it was directed by two younger up-and-coming filmmakers with something to prove, and they made a film that was appealing and entertaining and crowd-pleasing even to people that had little or no interest in the Bad Boys franchise. One reason why Bad Boys Ride or Die performed about as well as Bad Boys for Life a few years later is because A, the real world didn't care about the Will Smith slap thing. That was old news after a week in the real world. And B, it was presented and sold as a sequel, not to this 30-year-old Bad Boys franchise, but to this Bad Boys for Life movie that came out 3 years ago that you really, really liked. 4 years ago, sorry. I do not, I know, I'm going on a limb here. I'm going to guess that a Rush Hour 4 directed by Brett Ratner, starring a now 71-year-old Jackie Chan, yes, he could still kick my ass, but he's not exactly in the chip shape that he used to be, and Chris Tucker, who's basically vanished off the face of the earth by choice, I want to say since the third Rush Hour, though he pops up now and then, he's terrific in his one-scene cameo in Air, a film that is produced partially to placate the presumed wants of a, what can I say without getting sued for libel? A very old fellow whose movie-going tastes might not necessarily align with the general public. I think that's a fair way to say it.
I think you can describe Donald Trump pretty much any way you want to on this channel. I don't think anyone's gonna be too surprised or shocked.
He's a senile old man that will probably forget that he asked about Rush Hour 4 in 72 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. It is funny because it is, I mean, look, again, my devil's advocate stuff aside, the only reason this movie is even in the conversation, the realm of being made is because Donald Trump's friend, Brett Ratner, who made a puff piece documentary about his wife, Melania, wants it to happen, which is not a good way to run a studio or an economy or a country. But just looking at it from a pure box office perspective, it seems like a disaster all the way around. Seems there's no real good case for it.
No. And the problem is we can easily make the case that, and I'm throwing out random numbers here, forgive me, that the Ellisons say, okay, we'll lose $200 million on Rush Hour 4, but that's okay because Trump will then approve whatever horrible, disastrous plans we have planned for Warner Brothers, and that will make us billions of dollars, regardless of what happens to Warner Brothers. So ergo, it's a business expense. It's almost a tax write-off, for God's sakes. And that is a huge problem with the entertainment industry right now. On a more cultural level, I mean, and I was scared of this, among many other things, when he won in 2024, was like, you're going to have an entertainment industry that's capitulating to, all due respect, a mad king, regardless of if it's in their moment-to-moment best-cased commercial interests. So, and I'm going, I don't want to always pick on Disney, but, you know, it's they stand out, you know, anyway. Disney is among many of the companies that have been sort of trying to walk back the notion that their films are socially progressive and are in the room where it happens. And basically all the talking points that served them very well in the 2010s. And because most of the films were either good or interesting, that was okay. I mean, Black Panther was great. Last Jedi was great. Cinderella was a terrific remake that did not apologize for the politically incorrect elements of its predecessor, but used that as a jumping off point for character development and nuance in a way that made a very good movie. And even a movie that I did not like, Maleficent, it's still pretty interesting as basically I spit on your grave for kids. And it got to the whole, not just feminist, but angry feminism thing a year before Fury Road, which is obviously a better movie. So even before Trump came back, when Iger came back in 2022, I will argue that he was selling a narrative, whether he believed it or not, that Disney's struggles in the 2020s were related to the films having a reputation for being socially progressive and comparatively inclusive and having important and viable and valuable social messages. And to a certain extent, that's true. But the problem was, A, films like Soul and Encanto didn't bomb in theaters because of quote-unquote wokeness. and they either didn't go to theaters or they had their theatrical release severely kneecapped by Disney Plus. And Lightyear didn't bomb because of a gay kiss. It bombed for the same reason as Solo, A Star Wars Story, and Furiosa, and Transformers 1. People do not give a darn, however good the movies are, about prequel origin stories of supporting characters from established franchises where the characters are played by actors different from the ones that initially defined that character.
It's weird that that very specific genre now has multiple entries in it. We can point to a number of different films where it's like that doesn't work. You mentioned Disney's work in the 2010s, and I want to jump to Zootopia really quick because I rewatched the original Zootopia this week for a different thing, and it was very interesting to watch as an artifact of 2016, you know, it's made from 2013 to 2016, or whatever. But like just watching it as an artifact of the kind of late Obama years, it's very fascinating because it's a movie that's all about, you know, we can't judge books by their covers, but also there are kind of innate things in people, but also we can't judge them on. And there's this one sequence that jumped out at me in particular that was like the most 2010s dialogue, where one of the characters says calls the main bunny character cute, and she stops him and says, "Now look, you don't understand this, but it's very offensive for you to call a bunny can call a bunny cute, but you cannot call a bunny cute." And there's it's funny because I mean it works as like a piece of dialogue and world building, whatever. But it also is,
what if I'm saying
is
that
just
out of
it's
lust?
Funny. What's that?
What if I'm saying cute out of lust when I'm talking about Judy Ops?
Oh, well, that's a different Disney movie. I don't know.
You're absolutely right. I loved Zootopia. It was my favorite film of 2016, but it absolutely became something that's, I don't want to say harder to watch because that's silly, but it there was an optimism in its success and its existence that obviously got extinguished in November 2026, like any number of mid to late Obama artifacts. And again, I think, you know, I don't want to get too navel-gazy, but we could argue that, you know, America kind of peaked at the night gay marriage was made legal and it's sort of been downhill ever since then. That being said, that film is incredibly, quote unquote, woke. And I'll even, you know, I know that the film's the metaphor has been somewhat, it somewhat validates the super predator myth. And that's fair. Mm-hmm. I'll also say that the movie works pretty well if you look at it as a parable for the mostly proven, I think, theory that one of the reasons that we had huge crime waves in the 80s and 90s is because people were getting poisoned from the lead and gasoline in a way that it inadvertently, you know, and more so affected disenfranchised communities. So the idea of this film is like, they're only violent because we poisoned them. Well, that works too. Yeah. Anyway, the second Zootopia is every bit as socially topical and of the moment. And as Jeremy explains on the episode of the podcast that I haven't finished editing yet, even more specific to LA politics in a way that I didn't even realize. So, and I think that's one reason why it does work, because it's even more specific than the more general, this movie starts as In the Heat of the Night, but it turns into Guess Who's Coming to Dinner in the third act, where it's like, oh no, it's the guilty liberals that also need a talking to. But yeah, and that film, not only is it going to be another smash hit in North America, but it did 272 in China, which among other things is more evidence to what I was saying for a generation, which is that China may not give a damn about representation as we talk about it in North America, but they also don't give a damn about representation as we talk about it in North America. Black Panther made more money in China than Guardians of the Galaxy movies. Mm-hmm. It may not have been a woohoo representation matters moment, but it was a good movie that they wanted to see, so they showed up. You know, Coco made more money in China at that point in time than all the Pixar movies combined. Mm-hmm. So whatever reason it is that they show up for Black Panther and Coco and Soul, which made $55 million in theaters in 2020, by the way, in China, Green Book, which he made like 70, 80 in China, or Ready Player One, which was specifically American pop culture. You know, the mistake that Hollywood sometimes made was trying to formulate these bland, generic, vanilla blockbusters for Chinese appeal. And I count the remake of Mulan in that, which one of my second to last theatrical experience before COVID was the LA premiere of Mulan. And walking out of that, my first two thoughts were, this movie is fine, and China's going to hate this. Mm-hmm. Because it is basically like a boyfriend that spends so much time trying to impress the girlfriend's parents that the girlfriend just gets bored and goes out with somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to see this, and we may discuss this a bit more with Avatar 3 in a second here, but the narrative on the Chinese box office has now been for a while accurately. The Chinese box office has gone away. We're back to you pencil in anything that comes from China as found money. You don't count it as box office, as a taken at the box office as it was for many years. And the success of Zootopia is, I think, surprising to people who haven't been paying attention to what works in China. For instance, I was not fully aware of how popular the Zootopia land in Shanghai Disney is. I just didn't know that was a thing. And I keep my fingers in all the different Disney parks. I like to know what's popular around the world, but I did not realize that was an enormous draw there. But it's because the story translates weirdly well to the Chinese culture right now, right?
Yes. I mean, simplistically speaking, Zootopia made $235 in 2016. That was the biggest grossing animated film of all time in China up until the first Niza. That is what helped Zootopia become only the second movie after the second wholly original movie after Avatar to cross $1 billion. But it still would have been a huge hit without China, which is the case for most big Hollywood movies that broke out in China. You know, Transformers 4, it's a game changer. Did $322 in China. Okay, but it made $1.1 billion worldwide. So even without China, it's still like $870, which is good enough. Or like Captain America Civil War did $190 in China. Okay, but it still would have done $965 without China. So great. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. But the problem is like most of the movies that were only hits because of China, and please note I'm using quotes if this isn't a video podcast, Warcraft, XXX, The Return of Xander Cage, which I love, by the way, but whatever. Resident Evil, The Final Chapter. They either did not get sequels because they weren't really hits. And even Warcraft, that was more front loaded in China than it was in North America. They came, they saw, they said, bleh, and saw something else. It was their Batman v Superman in a nutshell. Or they were franchise installments like X-Men Apocalypse, Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, or, you know, the first Pacific Rim or Terminator Genosis, that did well enough in China to convince Hollywood that all was well in the Mushroom Kingdom. But when the sequel comes out, shocker, Chinese audiences have subjective taste as well, and they can say, no, thank you, I didn't like the last one, and they all tanked in China as well. Mm-hmm. But as far as Zootopia, yes, the simplistically speaking, it resonated with a populace in China where the idea of a young woman from a small town going to and succeeding in a big city was aspirational during a time of economic expansion. And I don't think China's government had any fingers on the scale at that point, but I don't think they were too upset about a film that presented that narrative as 100% good with none of the negative impacts. You know, and you can read other articles about that, but yes, it wasn't all sunshine and rainbows for those that made those journeys. And then, you know, 9 years later, it's a breakout sequel. And we see breakout sequels in North America all the time. Something like Pitch Perfect 2 or Austin Powers 2, both of which made more in their domestic opening weekends than their lifetime domestic cumes of the first films. Or even The Dark Knight, which broke the opening weekend and record in 2008. And then by day five, it outgrossed Batman Begins in North America. And worldwide, too, if you remember, you know, that one only did 371 globally. But anyway, so in a vacuum, it's just, okay, this is a Hollywood blockbuster that's a follow-up to a very, very well-liked Hollywood blockbuster that did very well in China. Good reviews, good word of mouth, lots of post-theatrical discovery. Because, yes, Utopia Land is huge, but it's only been around for 2 years. So for the first 7 years, it was Zootopia the movie. It was why Zootopia was popular. And you have a new movie that comes out 9 years later, great reviews, great word of mouth, more of the same. And you have generational nostalgia. It's not that different from what we saw with like Inside Out 2 or, you know, Inside Across the Spider-Verse or any number of between 5 and 10 years later kind of sequels where just all of that pent up goodwill just explodes out of the gate. But because so many of the Hollywood movies that excelled in China were either the same films that were doing it everywhere else or were temporary mirages, if I may, that's not something we've seen a ton of in China. Now, there have been Chinese movies that have spawned breakout sequels, I would argue. Mm-hmm. The first Wolf Warrior made 125 in China. Wolf Warrior 2 made 854 in China. You know, there was something there. And you could argue that was more of a Rambo Part 2 situation where it was a giant pop culture event unto itself, well beyond people that saw like the first Blood movie. Same with the Terminator 2 and maybe the Dark Knight. But there have been breakout sequels in China, just not that many Hollywood ones doing that in China. And as far as what that means for the new marketplace, nothing. And I don't mean that as a criticism. By all means, make your good movies that are good and interesting and appeal to everyone, and maybe you'll make big bucks in China, especially if it's something new or weird or different to Chinese audiences like Alien Romulus, which they don't get a lot of hardcore, ultra-violent, R-rated non-Chinese horror films, so that was kind of interesting to them. But still, that didn't stop Predator Badlands from making a whopping $14 million. But never, ever, ever treat it as the reason for the season. Don't make a franchise film or don't make any movie that is questionable in North America because you think, okay, but it'll do well in China. Because 99 times out of 100, that does not happen. It flops everywhere.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify has got you covered for selling. But when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process. From syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns, automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Yeah, I mean, that is the looking at these numbers, the one thing I worry about is like, oh, no, they're going to push to make a bunch of movies that, you know, are for, I'm doing the air quotes, for China, yes. You know, like, and that is already proven to be bad. Unless, should not be the lesson.
And this requires the industry to be far smarter than I expect them to be. Unless they decide to go that route and they actually take notice of what did well and didn't do well in China in the 2010s. So if we get more The Meg, which is a ridiculously fun, over-the-top co-production that had a little bit of respectability for, you know, people that want that in China, but also was a ridiculous kitsch fetch that was just a lot of fun and very well made, very well, you know, with a really fun Jason Statham performance. If we get more culturally specific movies like Ready Player One, which, okay, if that was anybody other than Spielberg, that would have been probably unwatchable, but it was Spielberg and he delivered because he's Spielberg. I want more comic book movies like Aquaman or even Venom, which like accidentally became a franchise because it was just so weirdly mediocre to the point of art. And I mean, and that's not just Tom Hardy's performance, which I think, like Chris Klein in Street Fighter, the Legend of Chun-Li, was trying to win an Oscar and a Razzie for the same performance. Mm-hmm. And even if the first one was an accident, the sequels absolutely lead into that. To yeah. Sony's credit, they knew that that film did not succeed just because it was, oh, it's just a Marvel movie. So if we get more weird shit that, you know, does well in America too, then yeah, great, awesome, wonderful. But, you know, if we're talking about Dwayne Johnson movies that used to do very well in China, I want more Rampages and fewer skyscrapers.
Yeah, I think that's fair. We do have one more China watch item here, which is Avatar 3, which is, you know, about to come out. I am in the rare position. I don't often take this position because I'm a James Cameron believer and defender. Even if I don't love the movies, I think he's going to succeed. I got to say, I the vibes I get off this one are a little worse, frankly. I think this movie's not going to do terrible. I think it's still probably going to gross $1.2 billion or something. But I think the number is going to be way down in the United States and Canada. And I would assume that they are hoping for enormous numbers out of China for this thing to work.
Yes, and there's a lot of caveats to that. It would not surprise me if the film opened with less than The Way of Water, which did 135 opening weekend and then legged out to five times that number because it's Christmas and people liked it. I have seen it. I'm going to be sort of, I don't know to what extent I'm allowed to talk about it, but I'll just say I am seeing it again. I am seeing it again when it comes out. So make of that what you will. It is also, and I think I can say this because we're talking about China, it's fucking weird. It's, I mean, in a good way, I would argue, but it's really, fantastically bonkers bananas visually, emotionally, in terms of the plot. It's not, even if you want to argue that like the first one was, it's Dances with Wolves on an alien planet. This is bonkers bananas hard sci-fi. So I think that makes it likely to do better in China because of that. And frankly, I think better in North America because I don't think it's a perfect picture, but I think for people that just want once every few years to take a vacation destination to Pandora, it more than fits the bill. And I do think it's going to be another situation where like it opens with only 110 and like, oh no, the franchise is doomed. It's like, yeah, but then it does another like 30 on Monday and 30 on Tuesday. And it's happening again.
That's certainly possible. I could be doubting at the wrong time.
But as far as China goes, In the 2010s, I assumed that when Avatar 2 eventually came out, it would make money on par with the Fast and Furious sequels, if not Avengers Endgame right at the tail end, which is 630 in China, which is still a record for now. And that would supplement a lot of the downturn elsewhere. It did earn 255 in China, which was, up until this week, the biggest for a Hollywood movie in China since the 2020, since COVID, frankly. Mm-hmm. But partially because it opened during a surge, partially because 2021, 2022, there was this comparative, I don't want to say a crackdown, but there was certainly a narrative being put out that those in the Chinese government were less concerned about whether Hollywood movies were successful. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't care as much about, getting that kind of money because they were less willing to allow American films to bring in that soft power goodness to Chinese audiences. They were less concerned about being seen as isolationists. And that's one big reason why they basically soft banned Marvel for a few years. And unfortunately, it worked. And by that, I mean, I spent all of 2022 having arguments with people that said that Doctor Strange was a flop because it only did 960 million, or Thor 4 was a flop because it made less than Thor Ragnarok. When in both cases, had they played in China and pulled normal 2010s China numbers, they would have played like 2010s Marvel movies. Mm-hmm. So the narrative that Marvel was on the decline was already in the water before they actually started crapping the bed in 2023. For reasons that I don't think have anything to do with that. I just think 2023, which was the start of Phase 5, is when they started, A, making the TV shows into mandatory viewing, and B, started selling their films as part of this one bigger universe that you have to understand to get the whole puzzle. And to Disney's credit, they never sold Marvel like that in the 2010s. That's what the Pretenders did. That's what the Copycats did to mostly failure. So when Marvel started doing that, when Disney started doing that, that's when the wheels fell off. But anyway, I'm digressing. What I don't know heading into Avatar 3 is it going to make about as much as Avatar 2, give or take? Or is it going to perform as well as I might have expected Avatar 2 to perform had it opened in conventional 2010s level circumstances? And in that case, maybe it does flirt with $400 million just in China. I don't know. I would say probably, because again, I think it works well enough to, it's like a Jurassic World sequel. Is it as good as the first one? No. But is it a gorgeous IMAX friendly movie where dinosaurs eat people? Yes. So everybody shows up.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think there will be an everybody just shows up factor. Avatar is interesting because, Avatar is being released by Disney. That was, I believe, a 20th Century Fox movie. I can't remember. Was the first Avatar Disney or 20th Century Fox?
The first Avatar was Fox. And this was back when Disney was not in great shape, especially outside of their animated films. And this was another example of Bob Iger's greatest legacy, which is he bought all of his competition and then pretended it was all it was all Disney all along.
What I want to get to next, which is that, Avatar is now a Disney property because Avatar bought, because Disney bought 20th Century Fox. It's 20th Century Studios, part of Disney now. And we're looking at something similar is about to happen with Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers is either going to get bought probably by Paramount or Netflix, possibly Comcast. I don't know. Well, but it seems like Paramount and Netflix are the two big options here, which could create a similar situation to the Disney Fox situation, which is that a lot of movies just don't come out in theaters anymore. If Warner Brothers is absorbed by Paramount, you're probably going to see half as many movies released in theaters that Warner Brothers had made. I would guess. I don't know. Who knows? Paramount says we're not going to reduce the output. If it goes to Netflix, they'll lose all those movies. They will functionally lose all of them. Netflix also says no. Which is the point, right? Well, and this gets to my what does the box office landscape look like after this merger? Once the Warner Brothers output is either absorbed into Paramount or eliminated entirely by Netflix.
Well, and I'm going to put on my tinfoil hat here, but I think it's backed up by recent history. Something that Netflix has done a lot of in the last few years is it seems like every time there's this big buzzy crowd-pleasing festival flick that might theoretically do well in theaters, Netflix flies in, drops a $20 million check on it, grabs distribution rights, and then it dies in the algorithm. And I think, I would argue, that they are doing that at least partially intentionally because the worst thing that can happen for Netflix is for that film to be successful in theaters. They did that with Hitman, they did that with Woman of the Hour, they did that with A Fair Play, they did that with... I don't remember the name of the horror film. They paid $17 million for it in 2024, and it died on the algorithm. And ironically, this was a year after A24 took Talk to Me and made it one of the biggest Sundance acquisitions of all time. I'm sure that's totally a coincidence. So when I first heard that, they might be buying Warner Brothers, my thought is they want to do this to kill theaters. There's no other reason for them to do that. There is no other logical reason for them to do that. You say, the IP, They don't need the IP. They can get 50 million people to watch Jennifer Lopez in just an action movie like The Mother. They can get gajillions of people to watch Bridgerton, which even if you've never read the book, that looks like a big deal to you. And yeah, sure, they have their Wednesdays, but the one thing that they have that their competition doesn't, both in streaming and obviously theatrical, is they can get sky-high viewership for just a movie or just a TV show that has a name movie star. And in most cases, it was somebody that got famous through theatrical cinema. Or, just a high concept. And the idea that like they need franchises and they need IP is ridiculous. Because most of the time, when they do what everyone else in Hollywood does, like, let's make a live-action Cowboy Bebop. Let's make a season-long Resident Evil TV show. They flop.
Yeah.
Or even something like the gender swap, She's All That remake. It's hot for 72 hours, and then nobody gives a damn.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have to do that. And I don't know whether they're drinking the Wall Street Kool-Aid that claims that they do, or... And again, this is a little conspiratorial, and this is all cutthroat capitalism with giant companies that don't love you back. That's important to note. I think if they're going to buy Warner Brothers, the intent, buy Warner Brothers, give only the very biggest movies a theatrical release, like, you know, Batman or It mm-hmm. Origins or whatever, you know, The Conjuring 12, you know, Minecraft Returns. Everything else either gets no theatrical release or like 2 weeks at best.
Yeah.
And what happens if that happens? The answer is that theatrical entirely collapses, because even with new studios like Black Bear and Amazon MGM taking a run at it, what we've seen over the last decade is that most of the smaller, newer distributors that try to do their share in terms of releasing studio programmers and star vehicles, they don't make it.
Yeah.
You know, Open Road, which kind of sort of exists as Briarcliff now. STX technically still exists, but not really. I mean, and again, if I'm getting some of the details wrong, I apologize, but that's kind of the point. You know, that's and so, okay, fine. They've destroyed theaters. They've destroyed their nemesis. Great for Netflix. Okay, but not only did that destroy theaters, what does every other first-party streaming platform depend on that Netflix does not depend on anywhere near as much? The answer is first-run theatrical movies. And as you know, in terms of viewership for film, except for Netflix in some circumstances, most of the viewership on HBO Max or Paramount Plus or, you know, Peacock or what have you, those are predicated on films that were released in theaters. Even films that bombed in theaters still generally do better on streaming than just a streaming movie, which is one reason why Hollywood eventually walked back the idiotic strategy of taking all their A-level IP and throwing it on, you know, a $10 a month streaming service for free. But once you remove theatrical from the equation, you also have removed the vessel by which all of your streaming competition pushes through the content, forgive me for using the word content, that is going to succeed on their streaming platforms.
Yeah.
That may be a bit mousetrappy, but...
No. No, this is, I've been arguing this for the last 5 years to anyone who will listen. The Netflix has systematically cut out the legs of every element of theatrical as it could. It as you said, it has captured the award season market. It has, whenever something comes onto the market, why do you spend $450 million on a Knives Out
movies? I know.
You do that to keep them out of theaters. You do it to keep them out of theaters. It's the only reason you do that. And they've done it with comedies as well.
Yes.
Comedies. The entire genre of comedy has migrated to Netflix and some of the other streaming services. People don't go see comedies in movie theaters anymore. It just doesn't happen.
And these were all issues that theatrical was dealing with even before the pandemic. Because, again, my big, you know, stump speech in June 2016 was how Netflix was basically going to turn movie theaters into video game arcades, where like the only reason anyone would go to a theater anymore for some kind of immersive, can't get this at home type experience, like we've seen with video game arcades, where once the at-home consoles matched up to or surpassed what was available in arcades, the only thing that arcades were good for were shooting games and driving games and VR experiences. And that was always my fear for theaters and, you know, up, down. But the problem is studios can't make money on these big movies unless there's a theatrical, you know, window. And sure, not every movie makes money in theaters, and certainly not every money makes up for what they didn't make in theaters and post theatrical, especially when dealing with huge budgets. And that's another misnomer that I see in the discourse a lot. Like, you know, when a movie like Furiosa comes out in tanks, because Furiosa was not that big of a global hit 10 years ago. And the percent that people love that movie, it's because they love that movie and they love Charlize Theron as Furiosa. I love Anya Taylor-Joy, but that's not the same thing. And then, oh, you know, it'll make it up on video, just like Labyrinth. Like, Labyrinth was a $30 million movie that made like $25 million in theaters. You could make that up on HBO. You can't make up a $170 million movie that, and I don't have the exact numbers, like barely cracked 150 worldwide. That's not how this works.
Yeah.
And I love one battle after another, but that's not going to make up the difference either, unless it like sweeps every Oscar.
Well, you know, you get the $200 million worldwide, and you get the Oscars. Then you eat some of the loss.
I should clarify that, because Warner Brothers has such an excellent year in movies, original and franchisey. In the same way that Netflix benefits by being judged as the sum of their content, whether each individual Electric State, you know, bombs, then I think Warner Brothers can be judged on the same scale. That yes. One battle after another was a 2020s DiCaprio movie, budgeted like a 2010s DiCaprio movie, especially noting inflation. 10 years ago, it would have cost $100 million, not $140 million, that unfortunately pulled 2020's DiCaprio box office. But coming off The Conjuring 4, Weapons, Superman, F1, which they distributed, but whatever, Sinners, Minecraft, that should be what the tentpoles pay for.
Yeah. No, that's what I've been saying this all year. You know, Sinners and Minecraft pay for Mickey 17 and One Battle After Another.
Absolutely. And I do think, and this isn't you, I do think there's a huge difference between saying this film can be allowed to exist and thrive artistically because in a healthy studio system, that's what the tentpoles pay for, versus trying to convince people that, oh, no, it was actually a hit.
Yeah. No, that's all people want.
Yeah. In terms of Ellison possibly buying Warner Brothers, two things. A, it makes me so mad that the reward for Warner Brothers' aspirational, auteur-driven slate that kicked ass beyond even my optimistic aspirations is that, oh, now they're going to get bought by a giant company that's probably not as good as they are at what they do. I mean, all due respect, Paramount has been mostly in the dumps on a theatrical level for a decade.
Yeah.
With the exception of 2018 was a solid year because you had A Quiet Place and Mission Impossible 6 and Book Club. 2022 was a great year. It was a miraculous year. It did so well that Babylon could be that year's one battle after another. Where it flopped, who cares? We got Sonic 2, Top Gun, Smile, blah, blah, blah. But other than that, that is the studio that has suffered the worst by the bottom falling out in the studio programmer. Because when your bread and butter was, you know, Will Smith in a movie, Adam Sandler in a movie, Tommy Lee Jones in a movie, and that no longer sells, what else you got? And Paramount does not have much. And moreover, by the time this happened in 2016, partially because the IP that they were kicking ass with in the early 2010s, late 2000s, stuff like DreamWorks and Marvel got set elsewhere. And the stuff they had left was Star Trek and Ninja Turtles and Transformers, franchises that had already peaked, if not already started their downward spiral.
Yeah.
And they've been struggling for a decade. Sony too, to a lesser extent. And the fact that they're going to, you know, that Warner Brothers is going to succeed with originals and new to you franchises and just miraculous performances by films that conventional wisdom says don't make money. Spoiler, Sinners made more than The Running Man. Spinners made more than Tron Ares. That the reward for that is going to be bought up by a, you know, basically a giant billionaire that's basically using it as an action figure on his toy box. That's insulting. It's offensive. It's horrible. But the other thing is, in terms of why Ellison, or yeah, why Skydance, remember in early March 2025, Mickey 17, a $120 million sci-fi adaptation of a sci-fi novel, R-rated, comes out, opens with $19 million, huge bomb, barely cracks 133, and all the talk of the town is that Mike and Pam are about to get fired. You remember that, right?
Sure.
Cut to November 2025. Paramount's The Running Man, $110 million R-rated sci-fi adaptation of a novel, opens with $17 million, won't crack 85 worldwide. And nobody's talking about anyone getting fired over there. Both films were from prior regimes, by the way. But again, the difference is just ridiculous. And the narratives that get put out, frankly, by the media, it does a disservice to the very industry that has to stay alive in order for them to have jobs.
Yeah. No, it's bad. It's real bad. I mean, my wildest hope was that Apple might get in the mix here, but no, it would be great if Warner Brothers could just be its own thing. Just split it off from the company, from the cable nets.
There's no rule. And that's, and again, not to get all conspiratorial again, but my big theory was that the streaming war was essentially a giant con, which would allow the industry to A, reinvent cable in a way that would pay everybody else below the top of the line less money, if not no money. Basically, residuals, back end, whatever. Yeah. Get all that off the table. And create a circumstance, an economic circumstance, where all but the very, very, very biggest companies could not survive unless they got merged with or bought by a giant company. Because we now have a situation where previously thriving studios like Lionsgate and, yes, Warner Brothers are like, uh-oh, they can't survive unless they get bought. It's like, yeah. Says who?
Yeah. It's a problem. It's bad. It's bad out there. All right, that was everything I had wanted to ask. What did we not discuss that we should have here?
Well, again, I think the broader, it's a bigger problem in the ecosystem as a whole, which is, and this sort of goes back to Rush Hour 4, weirdly enough, where like, it seems like, and maybe it is the craze, that so much of our modern economy is banked upon not giving people goods and services that they actually want, but creating goods and services that sound sexy in a shareholder's call that makes the stock go up because it presents the theoretical notion of future success, but to where it barely matters if anyone wants that item or sees that movie or buys that, computer program. Nobody actually wants AI, and yet we're getting AI. And there's nothing we can do about that, unfortunately, short of living in the forest, moving to Pandora maybe. Which maybe that's a reason why Avatar will do well. Another reason why.
No AI. So it's like, AWA. AWA has no AI.
It's not even just AI. It's like, when's the last time a big tech company created something that people either wanted or, wow, I didn't know I wanted this, but I love it now. And yes, that's a rhetorical question, but I can't think of anything other than maybe the
Apple Watch.
Yeah, maybe the Apple Watch. Even that was sort of like, what if your phone was a watch?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, again, in the entertainment industry, that's one reason why IP is such a big deal, because when you announce that you're making another Stargate movie, oh, that's IP. That did well once 30 years ago. Surely that will be huge in 3 years. Our stock goes up, or our earnings are, the media says nice things about us. And it doesn't matter 3 years later that either Stargate doesn't get made or nobody gives a shit. Because more often than not, nobody gives a shit.
Yeah.
Is anyone going to watch that Harry Potter show? I don't know. But the gains that a company like Warner Brothers Discovery, or just Warner Brothers, will get from the mere promise of a Harry Potter show, because that sounds like something that's going to be huge, even after the Rings of Power, are probably more than whatever losses they might take if the show is complete commercial disaster.
Yeah, I'll say the Harry Potter one's interesting, because I do think I think that series will probably be pretty successful. I am shocked at how popular Harry Potter remains. Like, I was slightly too old for Harry Potter, so I miss that. I say this all as a preface to the fact that my daughter came home one day and was like, my friends read Harry Potter, I want to read Harry Potter. I was like, okay, that you can do that, that's fine. And she loves it, loves that whole world. So all of her little friends do too. It's crazy.
And that might work. And again, the sort of the coin toss conversation is like, to what extent is the fan base specifically because of the movies? And again, that's the Rings of Power situation. The Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson's trilogy, was a blockbuster success because it succeeded in creating new fans of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Mm-hmm. Not because a bunch of, hardcore Tolkien fans felt seen. And Marvel, that's what Marvel did. And I think the industry has sort of forgotten that over the last few years, because now they're like, we have to, this is for the fans. This is for the fans. Okay, if you're making something for the fans, that's the only people that are going to show up. and you're not going to make any new fans. And to a certain extent, that's what Rings of Power did, quality notwithstanding, which is that it was something that was based on, okay, the only thing this has going for it is that it is technically Lord of the Rings, and there's some characters that you might recognize. And will Harry Potter be the same way? Maybe, maybe not, because it is based on the books with the characters that people know and like. But what exactly is success for HBO Max? Is it The Penguin, which is like a great show, better than I was expecting, but like it's a giant hit because 2 million people watched it in a week. It's like, and you know, I've been whining about this for almost a decade, which is that success on a streaming platform is, with a few exceptions here and there, is on a level so low that it would be an absolute disaster on any other media platform.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the shows that are successful on Peacock would be absolute bombs on NBC.
Yeah.
And that includes a lot of shows I like Poker Face. And that happens every time. All the media is like, oh, Poker Face is the next big thing. It's great. It's wonderful. And it's a modest success by Peacock standards. And then 2-3 years later, Poker Face 2 comes out with no publicity and nobody watches it. And it gets canceled after 2 years. How many times have we seen that in streaming?
Yeah, all the time. It's a problem. It is a problem. All right. Scott, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
I very much appreciate it. It's an absolute pleasure. I hope I wasn't too rambling and annoying.
No, it's good. This is always good. My name is Sonny Bonchi. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and we will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.